Hey, what's good, everyone? Gonzalo Orella here with episode 145 of the Gomeluco podcast. And this one, in contrary to the previous one, which is more like a tutorial, this episode is more like a reflection of a jigsaw puzzle. And let me explain. The pieces that I'm about to identify or describe for you may not seem connected at first, but this is my hope, that as I explain myself throughout the podcast, that it'll help me, but also you, see a clear picture, maybe even a pattern. The topic of discussion will be the upcoming COP28, which will be held in Dubai.
This is the Gomeluco podcast.
Because what I see, having participated in the Basel-Rotterdam Stockholm Convention meeting, the upcoming plastic treaty or plastic pollution treaty negotiations, definitely COP, and also the upcoming bond climate negotiations, I think there's a pattern here. And I think it's the development of a stance to disconnect oil production from emission reduction. And I think that will stir the pot in quite a number of environmental circles. It definitely did at the BRS, so the chemical conventions. It will definitely be topic of discussion or a undercurrent in the plastic pollution treaty. And 100%, it will come up at the Bonn Climate Conference next month and leading into COP28 in Dubai in December. What I'm trying to do is, or what we'll do during this podcast episode, is to connect the dots between carbon removals, so the carbon emissions and the removals of it from the atmosphere, indigenous rights, and like I said, surprisingly to a lot of people, the role of plastics and all this. So whether you are an indigenous rights activist or indigenous people's representative, state diplomats, or just an engaged person who cares about our environment, who shouldn't, by the way, this is a conversation that you cannot afford to miss, because the decisions made at COP28 will echo far beyond the conference halls. And we've all said this multiple times. I for sure have said this at COP27, COP26, COP25, all the way to COP21. But it is the truth. Whatever decision they make will influence our global response to climate change, definitely impact the rights of indigenous peoples, the environmental policies that we'll see develop around the globe, and ultimately the world we will leave behind for future generations. I think that is what we all want, right? Like, definitely from indigenous people's perspective, the next seven generations. And we've seen them. We've seen the dramatic images of John Kerry, and I think it was in Glasgow, showing pictures of his grandchildren. Same thing with Frans Timmermans from the EU, or sorry, that is from European Commission. European Commission, showing images of his grandchildren as well, like these dramatic speeches. We've seen them all that. Obviously, that's all for dramatic purposes, because we all have seen what is going on behind the scenes. So, and I think that is something that I want you to be aware of through this podcast episode, or at least give you some idea to see the story behind the headlines, to see what's happening behind the scenes. So that's what I want to dive in with you right now in this podcast episode. So like I said, the UAE, United Arab Emirates, is likely to put forward a compelling argument for disconnecting oil production from emission reduction. That's what I expect. And you probably too. If you're more into this whole work, you probably expect this too. Or you've seen it coming. That as well. What I've seen is that UAE has shown interest in using carbon capture and storage technologies. as a means to reduce emissions, while they would preserve oil production. So that is what I'm seeing right now, and it, which is reminding me of COP15, which was held in Copenhagen, where a similar issue was discussed, and in that case, it was REP Plus, mainly aimed to reduce carbon emissions from deforestation. Noble goal, obviously, but without addressing the root cause of deforestation, and also without addressing the rights of indigenous peoples, or not addressing it, respecting the rights of indigenous peoples in that context. So it was a plan with limitations and without safeguards. And you don't want this whole, what they're creating is REP Plus, for example, to be Wild West. Same thing with the carbon market mechanism. Definitely not with these carbon capture and storage technologies that they're trying to promote. And we see this, what we've seen with REP Plus, we see this parallel situation develop with oil and carbon capture and storage. So it might be seen as a middle ground. You know, the let's say that UAE does not want to phase down, or definitely not phase out. So they'll propose this as a middle ground. And the thing is that endorsing carbon capture and storage as a way to move forward for those that are like very anti fossil fuels and false solutions, this could definitely divert the focus from the imperative need to phase out fossil fuels altogether, actually. And what I expect is that carbon removal technologies are likely to emerge as another opportunity, as another focal point of COP28, creating a whirlpool of debates around practicality, consequences, implementation of these ideas, and all eventually also, hopefully not as a side conversation, but definitely as a main focal point, the rights of indigenous peoples or human rights in general as well. So at first glance, these ideas may seem to offer a very convenient shortcut to the climate process, promising to suck the life out of CO2 out of the atmosphere. But if you dive deeper, it will actually reveal serious drawbacks. Because land-based carbon removal approaches, for example, they could, they need, like I said, land-based carbon removal approaches, they will need land. And not just a small piece of it. They will need a large-scale land use, and will change a lot to the landscapes of indigenous peoples, and not just landscapes but also lands, territories, and resources. Definitely, what it will threat is also food security, biodiversity, and you name it, and we've seen such ecological and social trade-offs in the past. Large hydroelectric projects, you've seen them, whether it is in Panama or in Philippines, doesn't matter. You have these large hydroelectric projects used as implemented under the cloak of clean energy sources, but have often led to ecological disruption and displacement of indigenous peoples. So we must be very careful to avoid repeating these mistakes. And as the pressure is on, like every IPCC report, it emphasized we're at a point of no return, or the situation is getting more dire and dire. Like the pressure is being increased It also increases the willingness of people or states in this case to be more, play more fast and loose with safeguards, environmental impacts, human rights, and rights of indigenous peoples. So that's what I mean by we need to be very careful with this to avoid repeating these mistakes. Now, like I said, when it comes to this carbon capture removals and storage, like it's underlying this is the issue of the rights of indigenous peoples, right? So indigenous peoples worldwide, and you know, like it's, I hate to say it every time, because like it's the, like 80% of the world's remaining biodiversity is on the lands, territories, and resources of indigenous peoples. So, like, it's not that I hate the stat, but it's like, it's the stat that keeps coming up. And I think that we should be having more stats, by the way, not just that one. And also, the stat it actually is more on commodifying, or has a risk to be to commodify our knowledge, and whereas our knowledge is not just to preserve the biodiversity, but it's actually just it's more, yeah, it has a broader application than just gardening or planting trees and all that stuff, or taking care of the fish and the reindeer and whatnot. So guardians of our ancestral lands, generations, and protecting the rich biodiversity. So the biodiversity actually is already a carbon capture technology. It already is. You know, like we have trees, we take care of trees, and so it's you don't need those fancy machines to do that. It's you just need trees to do it. So, and these ideas or attempts or technologies or experiments, actually, that's what I said, the carbon capture and storage experiments will likely be implemented without the free, prior, and informed consent of indigenous peoples, which would be a blatant disregard of the rights of indigenous peoples. So what I'm trying to get at is like that at COP28, it must absolutely acknowledge the rights of indigenous peoples in the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. You have the preamble paragraph 11 of the Paris Agreement, which specifically highlights the rights of indigenous peoples. And we've been able to operationalize it in the carbon market part of the UNFCCC, like, which is called Article 6. So operationalizing human rights and rights of indigenous peoples is super important coming up to COP28 to prevent these experiments to be taking place without any safeguards and without any respect for the rights of indigenous peoples. So aside from the climate change, And I always talked about it before, did you know that the week before states gather in Bonn for the climate negotiations, or continue the climate negotiations, by the way, did you know that they will actually gather in Paris for a couple of days for the Treaty on Plastic Pollution? And this treaty, these negotiations, obviously, if you haven't heard the news yet, and it seems like right now is only one observer per organization is allowed in. So like if you have three people that you want to send from, from Alaska or Greenland, and you've been strategizing and saving money and everything else to go to Paris, bad luck for you, only one per observer organization. So one can go in and the other two can eat croissants at Champs-Élysées, if it's up to the UN. And I think, yeah, everyone is aware of it, and people are trying to broaden the scope of people per organization that can go in. However, as it looks right now, it's only one representative per observer organization under the, one of the excuses that they gave was, well, there's limited capacity. There's limited capacity of the buildings that they're going to use. Anyway, that's what they're saying. I'm not saying that I believe it, but that's the official explanation that they gave. Now, it will be in Paris. Probably this whole Paris thing was not on your radar. I get that, but it should be. It definitely should be, because this meeting and the meeting that was held earlier this month in Geneva on the chemical conventions play a role in this defense strategy of the oil producing countries. And so let me explain how all this, particularly the plastic, fits into this narrative of carbon capture and storage whilst maintaining oil production in the climate negotiations. As our world is gradually shifting towards renewable energy, the oil industry is looking for a new lifeline. And that, my friends, is plastic production. Plastics are, to a significant extent, dependent on oil. Around, I don't know the exact numbers, but let me ballpark it, 10%. 10% of global oil production is used as a raw material for plastics. And this dependency isn't as widely acknowledged as it should be. So it adds a layer of complexity to the upcoming plastic pollution treaty negotiations. So the expected shift in the oil industry's focus to plastic production can have tremendous implications. For example, currently plastic is seen as a waste management problem rather than an oil use issue. However, if the oil industry increasingly leans into plastic production as demand for fossil fuels declines, it could lead actually to an explosion in plastic production and pollution, which could actually impact also the already monumental event of the crisis of pollution crisis that plastic waste represents. We've all seen those plastic islands somewhat floating around in oceans and whatnot. But for plastic pollution, we have these plastic cleanup projects. And for carbon emissions, we have carbon capture, right? No, the influence of this anticipated plastic boom on COP28 and the plastic pollution treaty negotiations cannot be underestimated. Absolutely not. It is a move towards increasing plastic production as a means to keep the oil industry thriving in the face of decreasing fossil fuel demand, which could, and which is what I expect, slow progress in both areas of negotiation on the climate change as well as plastic pollution. So what I think is COP28 will be a critical standpoint because a major oil producing country is hosting it. And it has laid out this plan, and it's good in terms of, like, if you not in terms of like the ethics of it, but in terms of how they all played it out, how they all like put their pawns into this greater chess game. So if you see it, you're like, you should be impressed. Actually, at least I'm impressed. And so that's what I'm saying. COP28 will be a critical cross point. The interconnectedness of oil production, emission reduction, carbon removals, indigenous rights, and the future of the plastic industry presents a challenging, scary puzzle that remains to be solved. And what is also very important to a lot of people and is like a barometer of success is, for example, the 1.5. And so the maximum temperature increase, right? So you've heard it, 1.5 to stay alive. Now, the thing is that it could potentially lead to the death of 1.5 to stay alive and phasing out fossil fuels in the UN FCCC negotiations. And that is something that is like a very daunting and a chilling prospect for a lot of people, not just indigenous peoples, but civil society, everyone. Because what we already saw in Glasgow, the last minute change of states agreeing to take efforts to phase out fossil fuels changed to phasing down. Again, this was very last minute. And we saw these a very dramatic response from the COP presidency. However, you did see there were some articles that described actually the sleight of hand, the backroom negotiations that were ongoing that actually led to this. So this was not unexpected. It was actually expected. So what you saw was that was 1.5 was in Glasgow on life support. So that was 2 years ago. Last year, Egypt, Sharm el-Sheikh. And you saw that 1.5 was not just on life support. It was actually, people had to do CPR. In that, if you play out that analogy, it was on CPR. So question is, what can we expect from Dubai? What can we expect from COP28 coming up? So that's what I wanted to share with you in terms of like the background of it, what I see, the dots, the pieces of the puzzle, trying to make sense of it. And I wanted to share with you and also put, so that it puts indigenous rights, chemical conventions, plastic pollution, treaty negotiations, as well as COP28, into a context, but also see the undercurrent. The undercurrent that I think I'm seeing, and by the way, I could be wrong. I could be wrong. However, just for sake of accountability, I'm just documenting my thoughts and sharing it with you and see what you think. So that is, my thoughts on, the oil production, plastic pollution, UAE, obviously, at COP28 in this podcast episode. So yeah, that's it. Those were my thoughts on the matter. If you found value in this episode, please subscribe to the Goma Luku podcast. And also, if you can, share it with your colleagues, friends, and family. And have a great rest of your day.